that you will take up this taunt against the king of Babylon and say, and then it kind of goes on from there. So that's the first section. It's kind of a prologue that sort of establishes things and opens it up. The second section, if you're, you know, marking things off in your Bible, the second section goes from verse 4 through verse 11. This is talking about Babylon's oppressor, the judgment he will suffer because of being an oppressor. Next section is verses 12 through 21, looking at the king as a fallen star, and again the judgment that he will suffer. And then the final verses that we'll go ahead and read, 22 and 23, they serve as an epilogue or a conclusion. This is the way that they wrap up. God speaking says, "I will rise up against them, declares Yahweh of hosts, and will cut off Babylon, name and survivors, offspring and posterity, declares Yahweh. And I will also make it a possession for the hedgehog and swamps of water," in other words, nothing, "and I will sweep it with the broom of destruction, declares Yahweh of hosts." We're going to go ahead now and spend the rest of our time zooming in on some details. So first we're going to look at some things of that prologue, those first few verses. If we're going to follow this idea like we did last week of a partial fulfillment approach, right? Partial fulfillment, ultimate fulfillment, that we could say that, you know, looking at verse 1, sure, there were indeed a couple of times when God placed Israel back in their own land. Right now they're back in their own land. They were away from it. The ultimate fulfillment of this, though, of when Israel will be back in their own land and back to stay, is looking at the thousand-year reign of the Lord Jesus, and that is obviously yet to come. Verse 1, if you happen to look at that, you'll see the word strangers there. So it mentions strangers. Verse 2 mentions the peoples. Those are references to Gentiles. I wrestled with a lot of things in this passage. I had to do a lot of reading, and I guess that's just in general for the preparation in Isaiah, but there were a lot of commentaries that said when you think about this idea of strangers and peoples, in other words, these Gentiles, that they're probably talking about Jewish proselytes, in other words, converts to Judaism. And personally, I have a couple of problems with this. One is that, you know, when it comes to the idea of what the New Testament shows of what's going to happen before the millennium, it says that there's going to be this big turning of Jews to the Lord right prior to his coming back and setting up the kingdom. So it seems like the focus is meant to be on the turn of Jews to Christ and not people of turning to Judaism. So that's one problem that I have. The second thing is, did you notice that it talks about these people that accompany them, these Gentiles, that it speaks of them as if they were captives and servants? Some say that we should take that poetically, that it's talking about like a capturing of people's hearts, you know, unto service of the Lord, that kind of thing. Maybe it's talking about not real servants, but in some kind of poetic sense. But I prefer to take this at face value, to tell you the truth. And I see that, in my opinion, I think that these Gentiles are going to be those that we actually alluded to. Remember with the whole question and answer thing. I think that this is actually who we alluded to about Gentiles that are around that are not saved, that are living in the millennium. And so I think it's going to be some of those people that are going to be made servants among the Israelites. Now go ahead and go to verse 4. Some Bibles go ahead and describe what's listed in our Pew Bible as a taunt against the king of Babylon. You may have a Bible that says that it's a song. Others that might use the word proverb. The Hebrew word there just means figurative discourse, so it's a kind of a real general term. So as we go on through the second section, figurative language is being used, but even so, what it's trying to get across is really pretty clear. The leader that it's talking about here is brutal. Go down to verse 6. It uses this phrase, unceasing strokes, that this leader does. Remember we said that this is ultimately going to be in the Antichrist. Unceasing strokes. That means beating the nations down and beating them down and beating them down. Now, it's kind of interesting to me, by the way, that Israel is singing this song. They're told that they're to sing this song. And yet when this leader is put down, notice that they're not just singing about Israel benefiting. They're actually singing about the Gentiles, the nations benefiting from this too, which I think is a real interesting thing. Now, Pastor John MacArthur, who a lot of us know through his books or through his teaching, he points out that as you look at verse 7, and it says, the whole earth at this period of time, the whole earth is at rest and is quiet, it's peaceful. And so he says, how could this not be the millennium? Because we don't see this at any other time in human history, and we doubt we ever will. So he says, how could this not be the millennium, especially as we think back to what we saw some weeks back in Isaiah 9, where it said that when the Messiah reigns, it's going to be a reign of worldwide peace. So it seems to connect with that. And it talks about in verse 8 how even the cypress trees and the cedar trees are rejoicing, this idea of how even creation is being influenced by this evil king. Made me kind of wonder if maybe this is the opposite of what Romans 8 talks about. Romans 8 talks about the groaning of creation, right? And this seems to be like a rejoicing of creation. Now, we do have to talk briefly about verses 9, 10, and 11. I love the King James. I love the influence, the impact that it's had. But one of the biggest problems, in my opinion, of the King James is the confusion that it can create in people's minds between hell and Hades. Or Sheol. Hell and Hades or Sheol are very different. And so I thought that I would show this to you. Please keep this in mind. When you see Sheol being used in the Old Testament and Hades referred to in the New Testament, those two are the same thing. When you see hell being referred to, that is making a reference to the lake of fire. And it's different. So looking at it another way, when we look at Sheol or Hades, we're talking about the place of temporary punishment until the final judgment comes, whereas hell is the place of eternal punishment. Now, the reason I say this is because at the beginning of verse 9, the King James, New King James, they will start out and they'll use the word hell. But in the original language throughout this passage, it is the word for Sheol time after time. And Sheol, pretty much, most often in the Old Testament, and then Hades in the New Testament, most of the time it simply means death or the grave, you know, where the body is. But it can also mean that temporary holding tank, if you want to refer to it that way. Hades or Sheol is this temporary holding tank to reserve people in until the day of judgment. I think specifically Sheol or Hades is talking about the unrighteous being held for that judgment. And then hell is the eventual final destination. But that causes some confusion and it impacts something later on in the passage too. Verse 9 is where you start to see in this passage sarcasm start to come out. And it's where this taunt really starts to take off. So Sheol is described as being stirred up to welcome this dead leader of Babylon. And in particular, it says that other leaders are especially stirred up. And God is actually poking fun at these former heads of state when it refers to them, right? It says in verse 9, all the leaders of the earth. The actual Hebrew word there is almost always translated in the Old Testament as goats. And so it's like the prophet is saying, yeah, these big bad goats are going to be waiting for you. So there's actually sarcasm. And then it says, yeah, they're going to be getting up from their thrones. All that's meant to be sarcastic. And verse 10 imagines the conversation as they then greet this former leader of Babylon and they say to him, you're as weak as we are now. But then in verse 11, the sarcasm really starts to get thick as they basically say, hey, your royal bed right now, it's made out of maggots. And in that verse, in verse 11, where it mentions these worms, it's more sarcasm because the particular worms, the word that worms goes back to here, that was the worm that would be used to produce that deep scarlet, that royal color that would be used for royal robes. And so essentially what they're trying to say there is that instead of scarlet, royal scarlet covering this king, that the worms themselves are going to be covering that king. And the taunt continues into verses 12 through 14. And 12 through 14 is really the heart, it's probably the most controversial part of this chapter, of the passage at least. And so verse 12 says, how you have fallen from heaven, O star of the morning, son of the dawn. So in verse 12, the king is called, according to our Pew Bible, New American Standard would have it listed as star of the morning. And I don't know how many different Bibles. I put up a whole bunch of Bibles, so here we go. You can see that there's a similar phrasing with the NIV, the New Century. They say Morning Star. Contemporary English, Bright Morning Star. Christian Standard, Shining Morning Star. New Living Translation, just Shining Star. No matter who you are, no. Just seeing if you're there. And then with several different translations as putting it as Day Star. And then you have this one, King James, New King James, that goes in a seemingly total different direction, where they say Lucifer. This can add to some of the difficulty in trying to understand really what's being talked about here. Those are different ways. Some people get a little bit mixed up even further with this chapter because they think if we're talking about Satan here, if we're talking about Lucifer, other Bibles call that like the morning star. Isn't Jesus called the morning star in the New Testament? So if any of you happen to think about that, I just want to say that when you compare these phrases, they're actually different phrases that are being used in the original languages. There is a difference between them, and so don't get confused. There is a reason that's too long to go into now that they're similar, but realize that I'm saying that this is pointing towards the Antichrist, and the Antichrist is going to try to make himself a reflection of sorts of Christ. So the fact that there would be this similarity of Jesus being the morning star and this kind of being a star of the morning, that's actually, I think, with a purpose. But there's a tricky task now when you look to these verses and you try to interpret them. And I'm going to let you in on a clue when it comes to people doing Bible translation. Sometimes when you come to Hebrew or Greek or Aramaic, you'll come upon a certain word or a phrase, and they have to try to decide, is this a descriptive phrase or is it a name? Or a title would be similar to a name. So anybody here know what their name means? Raise your hand if you know. Okay, Jeff.
Like yours is God's peace.
Okay, God's peace.
Queen to rule.
Lion of God.
Appearance of God.
A lot of people in this room know what their names mean. Now, did you hear what Jeff said that our name means? I'll try to give you an example of this. Let's say that we had somebody who was writing in Hebrew, or they were writing in ancient Greek, and they were taking notes this morning on the service that was going on. See if you can stick with me with this. And that person were to write down, Jeff is in the sanctuary. Would you take that word and understand it as a phrase, Jeff is in the sanctuary, or would you end up saying, God's peace is in the sanctuary? Get it? So that's what translators have to deal with sometimes, because both make sense. It could be taken as a name or a title, or it could be taken as a descriptive phrase. And that's what they have to deal with this passage. So that's what they've done here. Most modern Bibles have not gone the way that the King James did, where they have gone with Lucifer. Almost every other modern Bible instead goes with a descriptive title as Star of the Morning. Here's the other tricky thing about this. If you take the following phrases, you can, if you want to underline these in your Bible, if you're that kind of person, circle them. Out of verse 12, you would have Star of the Morning, Son of the Dawn. Go down to verse 13, God, that general kind of term, Mount of the Assembly, the North, right? So that's verse 12, verse 13. Now with verse 14, the Most High. If you were to take those and to treat them as names in the original language, what they found out is that it fits really, really well into pagan Canaanite mythology. And so those who have studied this believe that it's actually making a reference to pagan Canaanite mythology. So in other words, continuing on with the sarcasm that the prophet has been using, inspired by God's Spirit, Isaiah would be drawing upon these pagan beliefs of the time, and he's saying, hey, king, you're trying to make yourself according to your own beliefs, like one of these Canaanite gods. But then he says in verse 15, but you're not going to be way up high, you're going to be way down low, all the way down to Sheol.
Now, some people think, especially those with the King James or the New King James, that these verses are making a reference to Satan because of that word Lucifer. I think it's better to do the thing that these modern Bibles do, to not translate it as Lucifer as an actual name, but as something that's descriptive. And I want to say that it ultimately connects up to the Antichrist, as we said before. One reason that I'm saying that is if you look at this passage, you notice that it talks about death, right? It mentions death, going down to the grave, going down to Sheol, those kind of things. No matter what your views are regarding the Antichrist, if you try to look in Revelation, Revelation 13 at least seems to allow for the death of the Antichrist. And it seems to imply that he's healed of this mortal wound and he seemingly rises from the dead. This is this cheap imitation of Christ that he's going to try to do. But as far as I know, we can't do that with Satan. As far as I know, it's not even possible for Satan to die. So that's one of the reasons why I don't think that these verses are talking about him. Another reason is that because although we know that Satan does try to exalt himself, we have some verses in the New Testament that really ring close to this regarding the Antichrist. So 2 Thessalonians chapter 2, verse 4 says this about the Antichrist, that he opposes and exalts himself above every so-called god or object of worship, so that he takes his seat in the temple of God, displaying himself as being God, it says. And that really sounds similar to what 12 through 14 are saying. There's one last, more subtle reason that I think that this is actually talking about the Antichrist. Go down to verse 19. After the king of Babylon's death, he's described as being a rejected branch. Anybody remember what the nickname is given to the Messiah in chapter 11 of Isaiah? Isaiah 11, what's his nickname? What's the Messiah's nickname? The branch. Remember that? We've talked before about one of the nicknames of the Messiah is the branch. It's the exact same word that's used here in verse 19. So the idea is that Christ is the accepted branch of God, whereas the Antichrist is going to be the rejected branch by God.